The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the November 14, 2014 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. A sweeping Republican victory. What happened? In a dramatic reshaping of America's political landscape, Republicans rode a wave of voter anger and frustration to a decisive victory in the midterm elections on Tuesday, seizing control of the Senate for the first time since 2006. By the end of a bruising night for President Obama and the Democrats, the GOP had assembled a Senate majority of at least 52 seats, winning 10 of the 13 most hotly contested races, including those in Iowa, Colorado, and North Carolina. Republicans are expected to win two more seats in Louisiana, which will be decided in a runoff in December, and Alaska, where a Republican was leading as votes were still being counted. The Republican wave came amid widespread voter dissatisfaction over the economy, the Affordable Care Act, the rise of ISIS, and perceived government incompetence. Mitch McConnell, who is expected to become Senate Majority Leader in January, took a new, more conciliatory tone in victory, saying he hoped to work with Obama to overcome the gridlock that has stymied legislative action in Congress over the past 4 years. "Just because we have a two-party system," McConnell said, "doesn't mean we have to be in perpetual conflict." The Republicans also significantly expanded their majority in the House of Representatives. As counting in close races continued, the GOP was on the verge of winning about 12 additional seats, gains that would give the party its largest majority since the 1940s. Obama said the election was a message from the American people for both parties to seek compromise and address the nation's problems. "I hear you," he said. What the editorials said. Liberals were dismissing this as a ballot about nothing. A Seinfeld election, said the Wall Street Journal. But the scale of the GOP's victory is a major repudiation of President Obama's governance. In states ranging from North Carolina to Colorado, Republicans pointedly put the president and his policies on the ballot. Despite Democrats' best efforts to distance themselves from Obama, Kentucky Senate candidate Allison Lundergan Grimes even refused to say if she had voted for him in 2008 and 2012. The election was clearly a referendum on Obama's leadership. Far from cementing a Democratic majority, this blundering president has helped the GOP make a comeback. "This was a victory of pure negativity," said the New York Times. "Republicans deliberately damaged Obama by blocking his initiatives on jobs, immigration, and virtually every issue, making him look weak and ineffectual." McConnell vowed in 2009 to deny Obama any successes, and that cynical strategy has paid off. Virtually every Republican campaigned on what they called the failure of President Obama, a failure they helped to create. Now that Republicans control Congress, however, it's in the interest of both parties to work together, said USA Today. Republicans know they have to show gridlock-weary voters they can legislate responsibly. Democrats can't approach the 2016 election armed with nothing but Obamacare with which to woo the electorate. Divided government doesn't have to be dysfunctional. What the columnist said. The Republican victory was wider, deeper, and easier than the pollsters and pundits imagined, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. In the Senate, not a single GOP incumbent lost or even came close to losing, while in the House, the party even managed to pick up seats in Democrat strongholds in New York, New Hampshire, and Illinois. This wasn't just a rejection of President Obama and his policies, said Fred Barnes in weeklystandard.com. It was also proof that Republicans learned from their defeat in 2012. The party's leaders worked hard to ensure that divisive Tea Partiers didn't make it onto the Republican ticket and outmatched the heralded Democratic get-out-the-vote operation. So what will Obama do now, asks Brian Beutler in NewRepublic.com. The last time he received an electoral thumping, in 2010, he tried appeasing Republicans, adopting their goal of deficit reduction and temporarily shelving his more progressive policies. Fat lot of good that did him. After this defeat, he should focus on cementing his own legacy and fighting for the Democratic agenda. It's time he waged war for real. If Democrats stand by their principles, they are likely to stage a big comeback of their own in 2016. Midterm voters tend to be older, whiter, and thus more Republican inclined than voters in presidential elections. Nonetheless, Democrats are in real trouble after this landslide, said Peter Beinart in TheAtlantic.com. The GOP is growing hungrier to win and finally realized after Obama drubbed the party again in 2012 that it needs moderate candidates with centrist appeal. In this election, Republicans deliberately downplayed divisive social issues such as gay marriage, contraception, and abortion. And it paid off. Republicans still have to do a huge amount to win over younger, Hispanic, and female voters. But while they remain in a political hole, these midterms suggest that they have at least stopped digging. In fact, this election is something Republicans can build on, said Josh Krasar in NationalJournal.com. They not only reclaimed red states they lost in Obama wave of 2008, they won most of the purple state Senate battlegrounds, picked up House seats in blue states, and nearly ran the table on governor's races. The big question is whether Republicans can keep their newly won footholds in a general election, and whether they can do it after Obama has left the scene. To do so, they have to continue to improve their bruised brand by reaching out to independents and moderates. If Republicans continue down this more centrist path, the Democrats' blue wall may fall. Our controversy of the week: Republicans, how to use their new share of power. Now comes the hard part, said Dana Milbank in the Washington Post. For 6 years, the GOP's only agenda has been to block President Obama at every turn. And antipathy toward all things Obama was the party's only real platform in the midterm elections. Now that the GOP fully controls both houses of Congress, it actually has to govern. The Democrats' defeat was largely an expression of voter frustration over the gridlock and incompetency in Washington, and now Americans will expect the victors to get things done. Republicans need to show they can problem solve, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. For Mitch McConnell, likely to be the new Senate Majority Leader, that means resisting pressure from the far right to pass symbolic fantasy legislation that Obama would veto, such as cutting huge holes in the safety net or repealing Obamacare with no replacement. Republicans need to propose reasonable reforms for Medicare, corporate taxes, and education that Democrats will be hard-pressed to ignore. If, instead, Republicans succumb to the party's extremist wing in the run-up to the 2016 presidential election, Hillary Clinton may as well start measuring the drapes. Republicans have plenty of serious substantive goals, said Ginger Gibson in IBTimes.com. And in Obama, who has only 2 years left to burnish his legacy, they may find a president willing to make some deals. Obama has already said he'll compromise with Republicans on tax reform, perhaps cutting the corporate tax rate from the current 35% in return for closing loopholes and deductions. Even immigration reform might finally be possible, said Al Hunt in BloombergView.com. Republicans know they need to improve their showing among Hispanics if they're to stand a chance in 2016. If GOP leaders can appease the right by getting even more money allocated to border security, you might see a deal with the Democrats. Don't count on it, said Jamel Bowie in Slate.com. This Republican victory was delivered in large part by the angry older white voters who make up the party's base. And they're going to expect the GOP-controlled Congress to make good on 6 years of anti-Obama rhetoric. That means a more than symbolic effort to repeal or destroy Obamacare, even though the new health care system is now fulfilling its promises, as well as numerous investigations of the IRS scandal, Benghazi, and beyond. The pressure won't come just from voters, said Paul Waldman in Prospect.org. McConnell also has to reckon with Tea Party rebels in his own caucus, such as Senator Ted Cruz, who has already promised hearings on Obama's scandals and is still vowing to repeal Obamacare. The desire to prove Republicans can govern is a trap to be avoided, said NationalReview.com in an editorial. It will inevitably divide the party between the Tea Party and the establishment, and compromising with Democrats will only bolster that damaged party's chances in 2016. Republicans should instead pass a raft of legislation that lays out a truly conservative vision, including replacing Obamacare with a market-based alternative. Obama will veto all of it, but those bills will build the case for Republican governance after 2016. That would be an unbelievably cynical strategy, said Andrew Sullivan in dish.andrewsullivan.com, which means it's the strategy Republicans will probably adopt. Brace yourselves for two more years of gridlock and partisan paralysis, brought to you by a Republican Party for which everything is about politics and nothing is about governance. Well, it was a good week for protecting the brand. After lawyers for Michael Bloomberg purchased 400 new domain names to prevent internet trolls from launching sites such as BloombergerGistuShort.ni and MrBloombergSucks.nyc. It's a good week for confessions after the Miami Herald reported that the New York Yankees' Alex Rodriguez has admitted to federal agents that he paid a fake doctor $12,000 a month to inject him with steroids, testosterone, and human growth hormone. It was a good week for the adaptive power of capitalism after fashion designers in China responded to the country's horrific air pollution by staging a runway show in which the models wore stylish oxygen masks. It was a bad week for stopping for a cold one after Australian police arrested a 37-year-old man who landed a small plane outside a pub and went inside for a beer, leaving the engine running. People think it was a bit of a laugh, said police, but it was very dangerous. It was a bad week for Saudi Arabia after Islamic religious police there announced that women deemed to have beautiful eyes may be forced to veil them. Officials say they have the right to force women to cover their eyes, especially the tempting ones. It was a bad week for whale riding after a thrill-seeking Australian man jumped onto the floating body of a dead whale before noticing the swarm of great white and tiger sharks feeding on the rotting carcass. "Mom thinks I'm an idiot," Harrison Williams, 26, said of the adventure. "Dad's not too proud either." On the briefing page, paid boots on the ground. The U.S. may turn to military contractors to fight ISIS. What are the implications of outsourcing war? What are military contractors? They are the legions of civilian workers who are hired to provide support tasks for the military. Some are former soldiers, but the vast majority of them don't carry weapons. The jobs they do range from building barracks and staffing cafeterias to guarding diplomats and intelligence gathering. Armies have always relied on such support staff, But since 9/11, U.S. reliance on contractors has metastasized. In the Iraq conflict, the U.S. employed 155,000 contractors, about the same as the number of U.S. soldiers there, while toward the end of the Afghanistan war, 207,000 contractors supported 175,000 soldiers. Even now, there are some 1,600 military contractors still working for the U.S. in Iraq. It's unclear what role they're playing and whether any of them will directly join in the fight against ISIS. For contractors paid by the U.S., it's technically illegal to operate offensively or to take part in combat, said Molly Dunnigan of the RAND Corporation. But lines blur quickly in the fog of war. Why did the U.S. shift to contractors? The practice really took off under President George W. Bush as the U.S. fought simultaneous wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, stretching the supply of soldiers. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld also believed the Pentagon could save money by bypassing government workers and contracting support tasks out to the private sector. Halliburton, DynCorp, Blackwater, and other companies were paid $200 billion to build infrastructure, feed and support the troops, and provide security in Iraq and Afghanistan. Did they do a good job? They did a tremendous amount of work, but not without inefficiencies of their own. The Commission on Wartime Contracting, established by Congress in 2008 to sift through the accounts, found that up to $60 billion, or about $1 of $3 spent, was lost to waste or fraud. The major contractors subcontracted out parts of their contracts to other firms, which then subcontracted to still other firms. Some companies listed salaries for phantom employees or billed for services not rendered. An audit of just 4 invoices out of the 129 submitted by AECOM Government Services found $4 million in overbilling out of $30 million in charges, including one charge of nearly $200 for a bag of washers that cost $1.22. Worse than fraud, though, were allegations that some of the armed contractors unjustly used their weapons against Iraqi civilians. How did that happen? In Iraq, Blackwater provided security for the State Department, protecting the U.S. Embassy and other diplomatic sites that in an earlier era would have been guarded by Marines. In 2007, after reports that armed Blackwater staffers were behaving arrogantly and abusing Iraqi civilians, the State Department sent investigators to Baghdad. They found numerous flagrant violations. Blackwater's manager in Iraq, Daniel Carroll, demanded that the investigators leave, telling one he could kill him and get away with it because Iraq was a war zone. Just weeks later, Blackwater contractors opened fire with automatic weapons in Baghdad's Nisour Square, killing 17 Iraqis, including a child. Last month, at a trial in federal court in Washington, one Blackwater employee was convicted of murder and 3 of manslaughter for those deaths. Will contractors be used against ISIS? Yes, in one role or another. The bases in Qatar and elsewhere that are the source of U.S. airstrikes require significant support staff to provide food and do the maintenance and cleaning of military facilities. President Obama has been adamant that there will be no U.S. military boots on the ground to fight the ISIS insurgency in Syria and Iraq. But contractors can also be hired to train moderate Syrian rebel factions or Iraqi Kurdish factions in the use of the weaponry the U.S. has pledged to supply. The real question is whether contractors will be hired as mercenary warriors. Is that under consideration? Eric Prince, the Blackwater founder, who now heads a military service company called Frontier Services Group, is openly advocating the idea. He said since the U.S. won't send troops to fight ISIS, it should hire a multi-brigade-sized unit of veteran American contractors to serve as the pointy end of the spear for local fighters. While the administration is unlikely to publicly announce hiring mercenaries, President Obama did say that the fight against ISIS would be like the action in Somalia, where the U.S. has a strategy of taking out terrorists who threaten us while supporting partners on the front lines. Those partners in Somalia include heavily armed private U.S. security firms. The contracting firms already in Iraq, such as Triple Canopy, are advertising for positions such as defense marksman, for which an applicant must be a trained sniper. When the U.S. pulled most of its troops out of Iraq, it made us even more dependent on contractors for security, says former Congressman Christopher Shays, who co-chaired the Commission on Wartime Contracting. The one thing that's a given, we can't go to war without contractors, and we can't go to peace without contractors. We'll look at the columns. That's from the U.S., Glenn Thrush and Carrie Budoff Brown at Politico.com. Title of the column, A President Who Wishes It Were 2016. Can President Obama reboot? That's the question worried aides and supporters are asking as Obama heads into the final 2 years of his presidency, with his approval ratings at record lows and his demeanor radiating sullen resignation at being trapped in a broken system he failed to change. People in his orbit say Obama hasn't checked out, but does give a feeling of being fed up. The president acts as if he wishes his time amid the endless partisan combat of Washington were over now, instead of in 2016. An Obama comeback is always possible, especially if emboldened Republicans overplay their hand, as they did during the Clinton presidency. But Obama's advisors have concluded the president will never again enjoy the approval ratings higher than 50%. That means he'll have to focus mostly on small achievements and explore compromises on tax and immigration reform with Republicans, if the two sides can work past their deep mutual distrust. But time for Obama to revive his presidency is running out. By next summer, the 2016 campaign will kick into gear, and the spotlight will shift to Hillary Clinton. We'll turn to the international columns. An editorial from the Indian Express titled, No Tears for the Boss of Union Carbide. India's most famous absconder has finally left this earth, said the Indian Express. Warren Anderson, former chairman of Union Carbide, died at 92 at the end of September. But his death was not made public until this week. Anderson was head of the U.S. chemical giant in December 1984, when poisonous methyl isocyanate gas leaked from one of its pesticide plants in Bhopal, India, killing 4,000 people right away and another 11,000 over the next few months. Some 500,000 people were sickened, and many developed cancers or other debilitating conditions. Anderson flew to Bhopal shortly after the leak, and authorities wanted to try him for negligence, but he left after posting a paltry $400 bail. Union Carbide paid a settlement of $470 million, but said its executives couldn't be held responsible for the accident, since the plant was operated by an Indian subsidiary. But to Indians, Anderson is the embodiment of impunity, the author of the world's biggest industrial disaster, who went unpunished. Back in the U.S., Anderson was forced to become a recluse, shuttling between his various homes to avoid process servers from lawsuits. But were his hardships, though tedious, on the same scale as that of the victims of the tragedy? And how they see us, throwing insults at Netanyahu. What on earth did the Obama administration mean by calling Benjamin Netanyahu chicken blank asked Iris Leal in Haaretz. U.S. reporter Jeffrey Goldberg last week quoted an unnamed senior official in the administration who used that schoolyard insult to describe the Israeli prime minister. Netanyahu, the official said, was both scared to launch wars and scared to risk domestic support by making any concession to the Palestinians. Apparently, the White House has just figured out that Netanyahu was only bluffing and would never really launch a preemptive strike to prevent Iran from building nuclear weapons. But why insult him? Isn't his cowardice a good thing? Would Obama prefer another trigger-happy formal general as prime minister? The slam was intended as a message to Israel about the coming Iran deal, said Richard Baer in Israel Hayom. The Obama administration is determined to cut what will, in almost all likelihood, be a pathetically weak nuclear deal with Iran by the end of the month. The U.S. will lift sanctions in exchange for a slowdown of Iran's nuclear efforts, a slowdown reversible in short order if the Iranians choose to break the deal. Obama knows he won't be able to get Senate approval for the treaty, so he intends to bypass the upper chamber by pretending the deal is a multi-party agreement, which doesn't require Senate ratification. Still, the White House is clearly nervous that Israel's opposition to the pact will inspire more pushback from Congress. Hence the name calling, said Herb Kainan in the Jerusalem Post. The idea could be to discredit Netanyahu's criticism by saying in advance that he had his chance to act on Iran but blew it because he is a coward. An equally plausible explanation, though, is that this really was just the venting of a frustrated U.S. official. Goldberg says administration officials routinely use such language, calling Netanyahu reactionary, obtuse, blustering, pompous, and aspergery. So what? Just a few months ago, Israeli officials called Secretary of State John Kerry messianic and said he'd been brainwashed by Hamas. This open mutual contempt is dangerous, said David Horovitz in timesofisrael.com. Obama and Netanyahu have long regarded each other as incompetent, wrong-headed, and ill-intentioned, but they tried to mask it for the greater good. Now they are openly working against each other, finding no common ground on pressing issues of Jewish settlements, Palestinian statehood, anarchy in Syria, and Iran's quest for a bomb. Each sees the other as hopelessly foolish, not a possible partner for a solution. Yet none of these problems can be solved by either country alone. The repercussions of this rift could be especially dire for Israel, which needs the U.S. far more diplomatically, militarily, economically, existentially, than the U.S. needs Israel. We have an obituary this week for a radio personality that I was a big fan of, and perhaps many of you were as well. The radio host who got laughs out of auto repair. Tom Magley Ozzie, 1937 to 2014. For 35 years, Tom Magley Ozzie and his younger brother Ray hosted NPR's Car Talk, advising and entertaining millions of would-be mechanics, troubled car owners, and people who tuned in simply because the call-in show was an hour of unrestrained fun. The brothers sagely diagnosed mechanical problems from callers' descriptions while bantering with each other about the mysteries of life, as viewed through an automotive prism. "I like to drive with the windows open," Tom told one caller. "I mean, before you know it, you're going to spend plenty of time sealed up in a box anyway, right?" After 60 minutes of wisecracks and Tom's infectious laughter, Car Talk ended each week with Ray cautioning listeners, "Don't drive like my brother," to which Tom would reply, "Don't drive like my brother." Born to Italian immigrant parents in East Cambridge, Massachusetts, Magliozzi was the first in his family to attend college, earning an engineering degree from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. After graduating from college, he spent several years working as a corporate engineer, but quit following a near collision with a semi-truck during his commute, realizing he was wasting his life in a job he hated, said the New York Times. In 1973, he and Ray, 12 years apart in age, opened a do-it-yourself car repair shop in Cambridge where tinkerers could rent tools and shop space, and later opened a traditional repair shop called Good News Garage. Radio found Magliozzi in 1977 when WBUR, Boston's NPR station, invited him and other local mechanics to appear on a talk show, said Bloomberg.com. Only Magliozzi showed up. His brother joined him the following week, and the partnership evolved into Car Talk, which was picked up by NPR in 1987. Magliozzi, who once led an anti-SUV campaign on the show, favored different cars over the years, said the Washington Post. At one point, he drove a 1963 Dodge Dart convertible. Later, it was a 1952 MGTD, his dream car, even though pieces of it regularly fell off. I had a Toyota once, he said, but it was too reliable. And the last word, where price is no object. The market for modern art is utterly irrational, said Vernon Silver and James Tarmey. Here's the proof. Art dealer Christoph van de Weg strode into Christie's auction house in New York City with orders from a mystery client. His mission that night, November 12, 2013, was to buy a specific painting for which the client was willing to pay an astonishingly high price. He really wanted to have it, van de Weg recalls. The work was called Apocalypse Now. By the end of the night, the auction at Rockefeller Center would make history many times over. As auctioneer Jussi Pulkkinen's hammer fell on the lot after lot, the figures posted on the screen behind him were as eye-popping as the works on display. A Francis Bacon triptych set an auction record for an artwork at $142.4 million. Jeff Koons' sculpture, Balloon Dog, at $58.4 million, set a high mark for a living artist. An Andy Warhol picture of a Coca-Cola bottle sold for $57.3 million, pushing the overall take that night to $692 million, at the time the biggest single sale of art ever. Apocalypse Now, the eighth lot auction that night, was created by Christopher Wool in 1988. It isn't much of a painting at all. Just black letters on a 7-foot white background spelling out, in all caps, a line from Francis Ford Coppola's Apocalypse Now. Sell the house, sell the car, sell the kids. Wool isn't a household name like Warhol or Koons, but his work has been gaining critical and commercial traction for years. Christie's has estimated Apocalypse Now would sell for $15 million to $20 million, more than double Wool's previous auction record of $7.7 million. Just 18 days earlier, the closest thing that comes to a coronation in the art world, the Solomon R. Guggenheim Museum had inaugurated a massive mid-career survey of Wool's work. When Apocalypse Now came to the block at Christie's that evening, at least two potential buyers made their offers via phone. In the room, van de Weg was sat near the front, with a diagonal view of the auctioneer's podium. The dealer was sandwiched between billionaires. On his left, J. Thomason Hill, vice chairman at Blackstone Group, the world's largest private equity firm, and on his right, hedge fund manager Dan Loeb. At the time, each man had a Wool on loan at the Guggenheim show 2 miles north on Fifth Avenue. Hill's was a stark picture of black flowers. Loeb's, called If You, was block letters that spell, without the dashes. If you can't take a joke, you can get the F out of my house. The King of the Woods, however, the King of the Wolves, however, is Apocalypse Now, widely considered his archetypal word painting. It is his masterpiece, said Van de Veg. As the price crept up toward $18 million, the dealer entered the fray. Doing battle now with three other buyers, he didn't relent. My client wanted the best, Van de Veg says, and so the price kept going up. Contemporary art sales at auction shot up 33% last year and 1,078% over the past decade. And those figures don't include private sales and gallery transactions, which dwarf auction sales. The boom has made single works more expensive than the market values of more than 800 members of the NASDAQ Composite Index. The same $142.4 million spent on the Bacon Triptych at Christie's would have funded India's entire Mars orbiter mission twice. Kuhn's Balloon Dog, a 10-foot-tall stainless steel rendition of a child's party favor, went for roughly the same amount the White House recently requested to develop an Ebola vaccine. At these levels, art has become a significant slice of the net worth of some of the planet's richest inhabitants, a portfolio-diversifying store of values for anyone who already has enough homes, bonds, stocks, or airplanes. Financier Ronald Perelman's fortune includes $3 billion in art, more than a fifth of his $14.8 billion total. Artwork valued at $2.3 billion is the single biggest chunk of musical mogul David Geffen's total $6.6 billion. And Los Angeles philanthropist Eli Broad's $7 billion includes $2.2 billion in art. The art market has reached similar dollar amounts, adjusted for inflation before, notably when Asian buyers snatched up Impressionist artworks in the late 1980s and early 1990s. But it has never seen such extraordinary prices for contemporary art. When a 25-year-old word painting like Apocalypse Now goes to auction estimated at more than a 400-year-old work by a Dutch master, such as Jean Bruegel, The Elders, The Garden of Eden with the Fall of Man, which sold for $11.7 million in July. If you're looking for something rational in the art market, says art advisor Theo Westreich, go fishing or go do something else instead. Prices for wolves have paced the boom. In 1993, there were two public sales of his work, totaling $24,170. In 2003, the number was 11 for $807,580. In 2013, the year of the Guggenheim exhibit, 65 public wool sales totaled $80.9 million. Among his downtown peers from the 1980s, Wool, born in 1955, was something of a late bloomer. Money first flowed to publicity-savvy artists such as Julian Schnabel and Ross Bleckner, whose prices skyrocketed and peaked well before Wool's art was traded in earnest. He came upon the idea for text paintings in 1987 when, while walking in New York, he spotted a white van spray-painted in black graffiti. It read Love, L-U-V, and Sex. His graphic riffs on those words launched the genre. The following year, Wool drew upon the 1979 film Apocalypse Now for new text, taking the sell the home line from a letter a character sends home from the jungle after going mad. The painting Apocalypse Now had its debut in April 1988 at the 303 Gallery, a sparse East Village space. Illuminated by track lighting, the work hung on a wall across from three urinal sculptures by Robert Gober, with whom Wool had organized the joint show. It was probably the painting of the year, Richard Flood, now the chief curator of New York's New Museum, later wrote of Apocalypse Now. The stock market had crashed the previous year, and as the economy slid into recession, humbling the art world, Wall's apocalyptic text became a kind of late 80s mantra, according to Flood. The show was such a hit that one couple bought the whole thing, urinals and all. Werner Danheiser, who fled Germany in 1936, had founded an engraving company in Queens and in 1952 married a secretary there, Elaine, who had studied painting. In the 1980s, they filled their Tribeca loft with works by Keith Haring, Kenny Scharf, and other now famous names. Though the price they paid for Apocalypse Now was never made public, a similar word painting by Wool sold a year later for $7,500. The pieces wouldn't stay in the four figures for long. Werner died in 1992, and in 1996, Elaine offered MOMA most of her collection. Valued at more than $5 million, the donation allowed Danheiser to join the museum's board. There was a twist. MOMA refused to take Apocalypse Now. They already had a Christopher Wool, and they thought they didn't need two, says the art dealer Felipe Segalo. In 1999, he says, Danheiser approached him about selling the work at auction. Segalo was the then head of Christie's post-war and contemporary art department in New York. "Of course I took the picture," he says. A few days after Danheiser signed the contract to auction Apocalypse Now at Christie's, Segalo mentioned the pending sale to Per Skarstedt, one of the most established contemporary art dealers in New York. Skarstedt implored Segalo to sell Apocalypse Now to him, offering up an alternative Wool titled Fool that could be auctioned instead. Christie's agreed. Skarstedt paid Danheiser $100,000 to $150,000 for Apocalypse Now, nearly double the $60,000 to $80,000 it was expected to fetch at the auction. Within days, it became clear that Skarstedt had gotten a steal. At the Christie's auction on May 19, 1999, Wool's Fool was estimated to sell for as little as $40,000. With Danheiser in the room, a bidding war erupted. As a shocked audience looked on, Westreich, the art advisor, placed a winning bid of $420,500 for the lesser Wool. Elaine almost died in the auction room, Segalo says. I wanted to hide behind the podium. He says she didn't speak to him for 6 months. With Wool prices in new territory, Skarstedt added Apocalypse Now to his inventory and waited for an offer. It didn't take long. By the end of 1999, St. Louis-based businessman and collector Donald Bryant Jr. made an approach, agreeing to pay about $400,000 for Apocalypse Now. But 2 years later, Bryant called Segalo, who was working as a private dealer at the time, with a tale of family drama. "I want to install it in my house," Segalo recalls Bryant saying, "but my wife hates it. She can't live with a work that says, sell the house, sell the car, sell the kids. So do you know anyone who might want to buy it?" Segalo did. French billionaire Francois Pinault, who'd bought Christie's in 1998 and houses his art collection in the Palazzo Grazzi, a restored 18th century mansion in Venice. Pinault bought the painting for around $400,000, Segalo says. It was the first time the painting had changed hands without a big jump in price. 4 years later, in 2005, Pinault decided to sell the work, saying his collection was too light on Wool's to justify keeping it. He likes to collect in depth, Segalo says. This time, the buyer was a player in the booming hedge fund world, David Ganek. "I sold it to him for $2 million in 2005, Segalo says. Then in 2005, Ganek conquered prestigious social turf on Manhattan's Upper East Side, joining the board of trustees of the Solomon R. Guggenheim Foundation and spending $19.1 million for the duplex apartment where Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis once lived at 740 Park Avenue, one of the city's most formidable addresses. In the same way a homeowner can take out a home equity loan, a collector can borrow against a painting, And in 2006, Apocalypse Now became collateral with Bank of America, and then, a year later, with J.P. Morgan. According to loan documents, the painting was pledged to J.P. Morgan for almost the entire time Gonecz and his wife owned it. The first news that the Gonecz had sold to a still unknown party came on October 4, 2013, in the form of a Christie's press release. The work was to be immediately offered up at the auction house's big November 12th show. That evening, Van de Veg didn't flinch as he bid until the competition dropped out. When the hammer came down, the audience broke into applause. The final price for Apocalypse Now, including the buyer's premium paid by Christie's, $26.4 million. It had appreciated roughly 350,000% in 25 years. After the sale, speculation raced through the art world about who the mystery buyer and seller had been. "It's a little bizarre," dealer Scarsett says. "Normally, even when someone's discreet, 3 weeks later, everybody knows. It could be someone in Europe or in China. You never know." Van de Veg has stayed mum. "The person who bought the painting wants to remain very quiet," he says. Apocalypse Now has been seen in public on at least one occasion since then. In February, when the Wool retrospective moved from the Guggenheim in New York to the Art Museum of Chicago for 11 weeks, the new owner agreed to lend the painting. Wool attended the Chicago opening, where he spoke with Van de Veg about Apocalypse Now. "I would love to know who the owner is," Wool said, according to Van de Veg. "I would love to know who owns my work." This was excerpted from Bloomberg Businessweek. We'll turn now to the health and science page. Using dead hearts in transplants. In what's being called a major breakthrough in the field of organ transplants, surgeons in Australia have performed the first successful heart transplant using a donor heart that had stopped beating, CNN.com reports. Up to now, donor hearts had to be harvested prior to circulatory death, meaning that they were taken from donors who were certified as brain dead, even though their hearts continued pumping blood. That requirement severely limited the supply. But doctors at St. Vincent's Hospital in Sydney were able to revive a heart that had stopped beating for 20 minutes by placing it in a machine known as, quote, "heart in a box," that bathed the organ in warm, oxygenated blood and other nutrients, thus preventing deterioration of its muscle cells. The heart remained healthy during the 4 hours it took before it was transplanted. Similar methods of nourishing and warming organs prior to transplants have recently been used with livers, lungs, and kidneys, and are expected to increase the availability of organs and reduce long wait times. This breakthrough represents a major inroad to reducing the shortage of donor organs, said Peter McDonald, head of the St. Vincent's Heart Transplant Unit. Some 2,000 patients receive heart transplants in the U.S. every year, and doctors hope this new method will increase that figure 30%. The first recipient, Michelle Gribalis, 57, said she felt like a different person after the surgery. "I feel like I'm 40 years old," she said. "I'm very lucky." And cocoa boosts memory. Eating chocolate has long been known to improve mood and increase blood flow, but new research indicates it may have an even bigger benefit: reducing age-related memory loss. The key ingredient, reports LATimes.com, is epicatechin, a flavanol found in cocoa beans. In a small study, researchers looked at two groups of healthy individuals ages 50 to 69. Half were given a daily drink that contained 900 milligrams of epicatechin, while the others consumed just 10 milligrams a day. After 3 months, the high-dose group performed significantly better on memory tests, and subsequent brain scans confirmed improved blood flow to the dentate gyrus, a region of the brain that's been linked to age-related memory loss. Researchers caution that the typical candy bar contains minuscule amounts of the flavanol, with dark chocolate having more than milk chocolate, and that people would have to eat up to 25 chocolate bars a day to get as much as the group in the experiment. It would make a lot of people happy, said the study author Scott Small, but it would also make them unhealthy. Researchers plan another, larger study on the memory protective effects of epicatechin. On the Talking Points page, Tim Cook, does coming out matter? Coming out is not an easy thing to do, said Steve Seibold in USAtoday.com. But it all of a sudden just got a little easier. That's because Apple's Tim Cook, the CEO of one of the largest companies in the world, publicly admitted last week that he is gay. While I have never denied my sexuality, I haven't publicly acknowledged it either, wrote Cook in a Bloomberg Businessweek essay. Let me be clear. I'm proud to be gay, and I consider being gay among the greatest gifts God has given me. With that watershed statement, Cook sent an important signal to young gay Americans still living in fear and demonstrated how far our country has traveled on gay rights in recent years. More than half the states now recognize gay marriage, and a growing number of gays and lesbians are emerging from the shadows. The most significant thing about Cook's announcement, said Mark Gongloff in HuffingtonPost.com, it was blissfully mundane. On Wall Street, the news caused barely a ripple in Apple's stock price. That's because no one cares, said Derek Hunter in DailyCaller.com. Liberals act as if it's 1950 and the townsfolk are ready to grab their pitchforks and torches anytime someone different is spotted on Main Street. The only place homophobia is alive and well these days is in the imaginations of the liberal media or the occasional aggressive drunk. If only that were true, said Stephen Thrasher in TheGuardian.com. In 29 states, a person can be legally fired for saying what Cook just said. If anything, the Apple CEO should have spoken earlier rather than stay in the closet until he'd made his millions. Why celebrate people who have never stood up as one of us until they are rich and famous? Don't expect more Fortune 500 CEOs to follow suit, said Eric Sasson in NewRepublic.com. Coming out in the progressive, youth-oriented world of Silicon Valley is one thing. But few CEOs are likely to risk doing the same in the rest of corporate America, which is still dominated by an old boys network that holds long-standing stereotypes of gay men being weak, passive, or inferior. That's why Cook is the only Fortune 500 CEO to have come out so far, hoping for more to follow his lead, at least in the next few years, maybe wishful thinking. Under the heading Boring But Important, justices split on Jerusalem's status. The Supreme Court appeared sharply divided this week on whether U.S. citizens born in Jerusalem can list Israel as their birthplace on their passports. Both Israelis and Palestinians claim the city as their capital, and U.S. policy is to show strict neutrality. But in 2002, Congress passed a law allowing Jerusalem-born applicants for U.S. passports to record their place of birth as Israel. Presidents Obama and George W. Bush refused to enforce that provision. In oral arguments on the case, Justice Elena Kagan said Congress shouldn't meddle in the sensitive foreign policy tinderbox. But Justice Antonin Scalia accused the president of ignoring a constitutional law in order to make nice with the Palestinians. And some notes. In the run-up to the midterm elections, there were at least 908,000 U.S. Senate-focused TV ads, according to the Center for Public Integrity Review. The North Carolina race between Democratic incumbent Senator Kay Hagan and Republican rival Tom Tillis generated about 11,000 ads in 1 week, more than one ad per minute. Given current infection rates, Americans have a roughly 1 in 3,934,300 chance of dying from Ebola. They have a far greater chance of dying from having their pajamas catch on fire. I'm sorry. 1 in 983,575. Being legally executed, 1 in 95,959. And being killed in an accidental firearm discharge, 1 in 6,492. If only white men could have voted in the 2012 elections, Mitt Romney would have won 45 states and 501 electoral votes. Barack Obama would have gotten 37 electoral votes. Despite weeks of U.S.-led airstrikes on the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, at least 1,000 foreign fighters a month are traveling to the Middle East to join the terrorist army. According to the UN, at least 16,000 foreign fighters have joined ISIS thus far. Crash test dummies are getting fatter to address the fact that obese people are 78% more likely to die in a car crash. Dummies currently are modeled on a person weighing 167 pounds. A new prototype weighs 273 pounds with a body mass index of 35. 43% of non-voters, people who are not registered to vote or who said they were unlikely to vote, are black, Hispanic, or some other racial ethnic minority. 46% have family incomes less than $30,000. And we'll finish up with a quote from Winston Churchill. Tact is the ability to tell someone to go to hell in such a way that they look forward to the trip. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.